Ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a pig. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes.
Hello, and welcome back to In the Garden. I'm your host, Daniel Rowan Tucker. Hard to believe this weather. I've seen more bare limbs and suntan skin around town than I have in years. Get that sunshine while you can. This clear air also invites us to find a higher vantage point and get a good look at where we are, on the shores of an island embraced by the long arms of the sea and surrounded by mountains clothed in dense rainforest, with glaciers winding down from icy peaks. And taking in the wonder of that big picture view inspires me to think about how we tend our gardens and manage our properties in the context of this huge landscape. How does it all fit together? How can we add to this beauty rather than degrading it? Is mankind destined to be despoilers of the earth, or can we learn to work with nature rather than against it? I believe that the answer to that last question is yes. But if we are going to create a civilization that is a beautiful and long-lasting addition to this planet, we must be willing to ask some tough questions and reconsider some of our most basic assumptions about how we live. In my own life, I have found the philosophy of permaculture to be a valuable tool in finding ways to move closer to the kind of world I want to pass on to my children. Today I'm going to share a brief outline of what permaculture is and how its principles can be applied to life and gardening here on the shores of Frederick Sound. Permaculture is a set of design principles that help us imitate nature and find the leverage points in our local ecosystems so that the gardens, landscapes, and communities that we create can become stronger, more diverse, and more resilient over time, rather than being brittle and isolated and in need of constant interventions in an endless uphill battle. Permaculture is a contraction of the words permanent agriculture. The term was coined in the 1970s by Australians Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. But it's really nothing new. The principles behind permaculture have been used by traditional and indigenous societies all over the world for thousands of years. In many ways, permaculture is just common sense, but a common sense born of long experience in working on the land and making efficient use of natural resources over time. The remains of ancient fish traps at Sandy Beach are a great illustration of permaculture principles. Using a low-cost and readily available material, alder stakes, in a specific pattern, at a very carefully chosen location at the mouth of a creek, to harvest large quantities of a very nutritious resource. And I have no doubt that it was the result of long periods of observation, experimentation, followed by more observation. In David Holmgren's landmark book, Permaculture, Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability. I highly recommend this book, by the way, for anyone interested in the subject. Holmgren lays out 12 core principles that can guide us as we design, build, and operate gardens, farms, and larger systems in our communities. Principle number one, obtain a yield. You can't work on an empty stomach. Grow something you can eat this year. Make some kind of short-term investment so you can support yourself now. Can't all be long-term payoffs. I've come up against this myself because I love planting trees and fruit trees and nut trees, and those are all long-term investments. And you have to obtain a yield. You have to find some way that the system can feed you in the near term so you can be justified in continuing to work on it. Principle number two, catch and store energy. Fishermen know all about this. We catch and store energy when we fill our freezers with salmon. Filling the woodshed before winter is another way to catch and store energy, energy that trees have spent years harvesting and storing from the sun. Harvesting kelp to build up your soil is another great one. And with good timing, a fall storm could put your year's supply right at the top of the beach at your doorstep. Principle number three, observe and interact. Notice how those flows of energy and nutrients move through the landscape. When we look closely at nature, we will always learn something new. Spend time observing so you know where your actions will have the most leverage. To me, gardening is a never-ending conversation with the land. I watch, then I try something, then nature shows me something, then I try something else, and on and on. Principle number four, creatively use and respond to change. Plants and animals don't hesitate to take advantage of change. Unlike us, they are focused on the present, and they don't waste time trying to relive the past once it's gone. A fresh road cut or a landslide becomes fertile ground for a new alder grove. If we can learn to be adaptable, we too will always find opportunities in a changing world. Principle number five, use edges and value the marginal. Our culture tends to focus on maximizing economies of scale, which means using big spaces and filling them up. But special things happen at the edges and on the margins. The edge of a forest attracts more birds and insects. The edge of the land and the sea is the beach, which attracts all kinds of animals and people for many reasons. The edges of paths are a great place to garden because they get more attention from passers-by. I think the margin of the bike path along the Narrows, out past where South Nordic Drive turns into Mitkoff Highway, is a great opportunity for some kind of public garden or public landscaping. Principle number six, use and value diversity. Diverse ecosystems are always more stable over time than less diverse ones. A forest composed of only one tree species can turn gray and die in the course of a few years when a pest or pathogen arrives. I've seen this firsthand with bark beetle outbreaks on the Kenai Peninsula. The more different species there are, the greater chance there is that something will always be thriving and ready to fill in gaps when something else dies. Small farmers around the world have traditionally hedged their investments by growing many different crops. They won't cash in on high prices the same way that a big monoculture farm can, but they also know they won't starve when prices crash for a certain crop. I've read that traditional potato growers in Peru would even go so far not only growing many different varieties of potato, they would cultivate different patches of ground in different microclimates, like one on the north side of a mountain, one on the south side of a mountain, one down in the bottom of the valley, one way up high on the slope, in all these different microclimates. And in that way, they spread out their risks so that depending on the vagaries of the weather, if it was a really hot year or a cold year or a wet year or a dry year, one of those patches of potatoes was almost guaranteed to do well. Because they were in so many different situations. Again, they were sacrificing their potential maximum yield, but minimizing their risk. And that's the way that a lot of animals operate too, because they don't want to starve. Principle number seven, use small and slow solutions. Working slowly gives us time to learn and adjust our process. I think there are times when it's appropriate to bring in the heavy equipment and get a lot done in a short amount of time, but only with proper planning and forethought. If we move too fast, we're more likely to damage something irreplaceable. This brings to mind an experience I had on my former property on San Juan Island, where I had 5 acres of brushy, cut-over, clear-cut, kind of second-growth clear-cut on a hillside. And I had this vision for an orchard of fruit trees and nut trees and, you know, started clearing trees one by one with hand tools and, you know, found myself wishing I had the money to just hire a bulldozer and clear everything right away and start with a blank slate. But over time, I carved out a niche in the forest there and made openings and planted different trees and kind of slowly chipped away at it. And in the process, learned a lot about the land and what was already growing there and the plants and animals that were there. And also it was a much more gradual adjustment of taking out trees one by one. And then later somebody bought a neighboring parcel, and they brought in the bulldozers and, made things happen very rapidly, but it was kind of shocking, and everyone in the neighborhood was sort of taken aback, and you know, all of a sudden there was this huge swath of bare dirt, and the guy did plant a bunch of fruit trees, but it was just a very different feeling. It was kind of like the old place was just destroyed or wiped out, and then something new was laid down, rather than a sort of a gradual transformation, which is what's possible when you work a little bit more slowly and carefully. Principle number 8, integrate rather than segregate. Think about if you have chickens, how can your chickens be part of your garden rather than being isolated in their coop? Now, I know this takes a lot more effort and planning. I've raised chickens. You know, I've experimented with combining chickens with my garden, free ranging, you know, moving them around with a net, all kinds of different things, chicken tractors. There's a lot of different things people do. It's always more work, but the magic that happens when you have chickens foraging, you know, say through some beds that you just harvested the leafy greens out of, and then the chickens come through and kind of till everything up and eat the bugs and fertilize along the way, you know, and you get some better color in your eggs because the chickens are foraging in some new places, and there's some really cool synchronicities that can happen if we are able to create that rather than just saying, you know, the chickens stay in the chicken coop, the garden is just for the plants. So different way to think about things. And that's how nature works. Nature very rarely segregates. Plants and animals are all over each other, and somehow it all works. Principle number 9, design from patterns to details. So understand what you're doing on the macro level in the big picture of the design before you get caught up in small details. The details should always be subservient to the highest goals and the largest patterns, not the other way around. Principle number 10, produce no waste. Compost whatever can be turned into healthy soil. Wherever there is waste, there is opportunity for something to be utilized and turned into something else. There's no waste in nature. Something always uses whatever other things aren't using. Every dead animal turns into food or fertilizer for something else. The only places on Earth where agriculture has been practiced continuously for thousands of years without creating desertification and wastelands are places like China, Japan, and Korea, where people systematically composted all organic matter, including human waste. I know of a few locals here with well-functioning compost toilet systems. I think this idea merits more attention. If you're curious about those traditional agriculture systems in East Asia, I highly recommend a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries. And this is a classic in the permaculture world. It was written by a man named F.H. King, who was the United States Secretary of Agriculture, I believe, at one point about 100 years ago when he wrote the book. And he took an extensive journey throughout China, Japan, Korea, maybe some other places, but primarily those three nations in East Asia, and studied their traditional farming systems, which at the time were still very much prevalent. They hadn't yet gone through the Green Revolution and mechanization and tractors and pesticides and all of that. It was mostly people working small plots of land by hand and using very, very time-tested permaculture practices in some really fascinating ways, really, really sophisticated forms of crop rotation, composting everything under the sun, as I mentioned, and using every possible square inch of soil to the greatest potential. Really, really interesting book with a lot of black and white photographs. Farmers of 40 centuries. You can get paperback copies pretty cheap. Principle number 11, use and value renewable resources and services. On a long enough time scale, everything that is not a renewable resource will be gone. This means that renewable resources like trees, forests, fish, soil, water, and sunlight are incredibly important because they could always be with us if we take care of them. Principle number 12, apply self-regulation and accept feedback. Be honest with yourself about your mistakes. Mistakes are how we learn. Listen to criticism and different perspectives. If we transcend the ego, we can learn a lot. Let go of things that we're overly attached to and confront our mistakes. This also gets back to principle number 3, observe and interact. It's about the process of learning over time, integrating what you learned, making changes, making adjustments. Like I said, to me, gardening is a conversation with nature. Every year is different. Every piece of land is different. There's always something new happening. The new insect showing up, different weather. The rain we had this year is a great example. Just an extreme that most of us hadn't seen before. There's always something new to learn. Permaculture has many different layers. A lot of people also use it for mapping out their property. Permaculture maps and diagrams can be really useful as a way to get a sense of how to utilize your, not just your garden, but your entire property, because your garden space is always nested within the larger context of your property and the foot traffic and vehicle traffic and sunlight and wind and locations of buildings and all those different things. So there's some really great permaculture resources out there to help you plan how to use your property or any piece of land that you're utilizing. One of the most well-known features of that is the zone system, where you divide the land into different zones based on where you are and how frequently you visit those parts of the land. So your zone zero would be like your house, where you are every single day. Zone one would be your front yard, whatever is by your doorstep, something that you walk by every day. Zone two is slightly farther out. Zone three is farther than that, and on to where zone five could be, that special little grove of trees down by the creek where, you go every once in a while, or even the wilderness of some kind. It's kind of the opposite extreme of a place that you don't go very much, but dividing up the land based on what your patterns of use are can be a really useful way to think about designing your space. And, if you want a vegetable garden with, high maintenance fetch, which, most annual vegetables tend to be pretty high maintenance in the scheme of things. They need our care. You want it to be as close to zone one as possible so that you can conveniently spend a lot of time there. Old Chinese proverb, the best fertilizer is the gardener's shadow. So if you want your garden to thrive, spend a lot of time in it. So put it somewhere near your front door that you're going to spend a lot of time. My ultimate goals in being a gardener are to surround myself with beautiful and healthy plants animals, and people. Rich, well-balanced soil creates vigorous and tasty plants, which feed strong, well-developed animals and people. Healthy people who are in touch with their local ecosystems can shepherd those ecosystems towards greater diversity and abundance in a win-win situation. That's all for today. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from Bloomsterhus, filled with plants and supplies for the spring, like trees, shrubs, and potting soil. Open on Main Street, 10 to 5, Monday through Saturday, and at 907-772-2566.
Ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a pig. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love, homegrown tomatoes. Well, you can go out to eat, and that's for sure, but it's nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs. You can eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on a side. Put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'll life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
This life I lead, well, I'd be Johnny Tomato Seed, 'cause I know what this country needs. It's homegrown tomatoes in every yard you see. When I die, don't bury me in a box in a cemetery. Out in the garden, be much better, and I could be pushing up homegrown tomatoes.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love.